Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Faith Dust, the radio show where we listen to your voice and talk about the corruption we all face every day in our courts. America's courts have been co-opted by organized crime organizations operating under the color of law to defraud their victims of life, property, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We the people must confront the perpetrators of these crimes to have any hope of creating transparency and accountability in our courts and repairing our broken legal system. We stand with you to create this accountability. It's time to face us. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Face Us Radio on Blog Talk Radio, Hidden Truth Revealed, and this is the Inside Scoop. Today is February 21st, 2024. My name is Robin Austin, and I'm with my co-host, Luann Fleming.
Hello, everybody. It's Luann Fleming. Oh, boy, we've got a really good show for you tonight. I can't wait to get this started. We got a great show. And I know Hillary is on right now. Let me go ahead and bring her in. And I think I just pulled up Marcy, but Hillary is first in queue. So go ahead. Say hello to everybody, Hillary, and then we're going to bring Marcy on real quick.
Hi, everyone, and wow, I did not know who our guest was going to be tonight, and I just found out, and I'm fired up and ready to go. I will just give a little quickly information. There is going to be a thriller in Manila next week concerning a guardian. I won't put out her name. In my home county, Collier County, and she's been around for decades, and it looks like there is a new auditor for the Inspector General's office that is cracking the whip. So there's a three-hour hearing 10 minutes away in Collier County. So I, along with a few others, will be there, and they are hoping this Inspector General to have her removed from all of her cases, and I think she has about 70 cases. So that's something to be excited about, as it is with our guest, our special guest tonight. So looking forward to the show. Thanks again.
Exactly. We also have Marcy Friedman coming on, and we're going to introduce her. Marcy, say hello to everybody, and then we'll bring our guest on. Hi, Marcy.
Well, hi, Luann, Robin, and Hillary.
Hello.
And America from coast to coast, you know. We are Brava America. This is what I call it in my town. I'm Brava. We are Brava because our mothers have been held hostage, captive, isolated, trafficked, neglected for exploitation. And I know that this is a big topic for Luann tonight, especially because of her mom. But here I am, here we are, and all I can say is that our mothers raised really strong women, and love is so profound that we're not going to give up till we seek justice. So there'll be no more Lilia Martinez's or Luann's mother or any other Hillary's dad that have suffered these warlike crimes, worse than communist country. And then I'll have some questions for Leslie, which I'm so excited to have her. Going pro se,
exactly.
It's really the way to go.
Exactly. Well, that was great, you guys. Thank you so much for sharing everything with us. I'm so glad you guys are our co-hosts, aren't we, Robin?
Absolutely.
We couldn't have a better team than this. Anyway, we've got a great guest tonight. I am so excited. I mean, I just love our next guest. Her name, everybody, is Leslie Federico. She's now a retired attorney. She's going to join us and talk to us how she can help you as a pro se litigant. Another, she was an attorney, I'm going to tell everybody in Florida, facing disciplinary action. She chose to surrender her license and now is offering family law lawyers visual workshop. So this is going to be really exciting to talk to her And let's go ahead and bring her in. We're not going to waste one more second of our time with her, without her on our show. Right, Robin? Everybody?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Leslie Ferdorigos, welcome to our show. It's so delightful to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Everybody on our show knows who you are. Can you just kind of give our audience and what happened? And I know you're an attorney for a lot of people out there in Florida. Can you kind of give us an idea what you did and then kind of what happened and why you're here now? I mean,
and what brought you to this place in your career?
Yeah.
Yeah. I like to consider myself an attorney that tries to keep families together because I not only practice guardianship, you know, and I didn't practice as a typical guardian attorney. I was there for one purpose, and that was to restore the rights to the person that was being held as a ward, and also, you know, in certain circumstances, reunite them with their children who had been court-ordered to not be able to contact them. So that was the only type of representation that I was willing to do in a guardianship case. Aside from doing guardianship, I also was the guru, I guess you could say, in parental alienation cases where children in family court were taken from one of the parents, whether it was through court orders or there was a multitude of ways, but the typical was the court emergency ex parte motions that stopped parents for years from seeing their kids. And then the other type of law that I practiced was when parents had a state agency come in and remove their children and then put their children up for adoption, terminating their rights. I would represent the parents whose rights were up to be terminated to try to stop that process from happening. So those were the three areas of law, but they might have involved different courts, but they all, those were the three courts that were able to take and tear apart families, and those are the courts that I practiced and to reunite families. Do you want me to expand on what happened to me?
yeah. Just a little bit. Then I have Marcy coming on to ask a few questions. But yes, please do.
Yeah. So I was very naive. I had my entire life, I guess, back in my 20s, I had worked with adults and children with disabilities in Chicago. I always worked and I always had a platform for least restrictive measures. I was brought into audit institutions and group homes that certain people with disabilities were being held in. I was absolutely disgusted with the institutionalization of people in general. And when I went into law school, I took on the platform of, I originated an organization on campus called Citizens, or legal advocates for citizens with disabilities. And the whole premise of what I was doing was to stop any sort of confinement and institutionalization, whether it be the elderly, whether it be disabled, any life group that would be affected. But when I initially started practicing law, all my cases came in from family court, I had no idea it was coming, but I got a call from New York one day, and somebody was begging me to help get their friend out of being locked up. And she was a doctor, and she was in her 50s, and I just assumed it was a Baker Act because that's all the experience I'd ever had. And once I got into that case and I went to go meet her, she was being held in a nursing home with 80 and 90-year-olds with dementia. She was in her 50s. The nursing home was so horrendous that I literally, my eyes were burning from the scent of urine and pine salt. That's how bad it was. And she begged me to get her out. And that was my first encounter with guardianship. There was something about this case, and I realized why. And this is what kept me motivated to helping get people out of guardianships, that I literally was so disgusted at the inhumane treatment of this person. I was disgusted with, you know, just the awe. And I was brought into this case, and the first encounter I had with a guardianship attorney, he didn't know who I was. And he told me, welcome to the cabal, basically is what he said to me. And he had told me that this, my client, needed to be institutionalized because she had bipolar disorder. Well, little did he know that I spent my entire life fighting against institutionalization. So he obviously stumbled, you know, on the wrong attorney, right? I refused to submit to this group. I could have been accepted by them, but I didn't. And I fought really, really hard against them. And after that case, I guess, you know, the guardianship world within Florida is pretty small. They're all part of the elder law group. They'll mingle and talk and attend events and whatever else they do together. My name got passed around Florida to these different elder law attorneys, so it didn't matter what county I was going to. They already knew who I was, and they were already treating me hostile because they knew that I was not, you know, I didn't believe yeah, what they were doing. And so it wasn't long until I got some enemies. I prevailed in some cases. I think I ended up restoring the rights to, I think it was nine wards in Florida. And of course, when I restored the rights to these wards, it stopped the income flow to the attorneys. So I was affecting, their ability to make money. And so then I had a real vendetta, and overnight I had, and then the news took interest in everything, and I was interviewed on the news, and the next thing you know, I have all these bar complaints coming in, but they weren't from the clients, they were from the elder law attorneys, and guardians too, guardians and the attorneys. So I later found out that the ACAP, which is the initial place you send bar complaints to, they have the ability to dismiss a complaint, you know, in the early stages, or they can move it on to an investigative level. I found out the person that was the head of ACAP happened to be a former elder law attorney. So,
wow.
And there was just, I would sit there and see, like, I would file complaints against legitimate concerns with what was happening to people. And I would be, my stuff would be dropped, but they would hold on to these complaints that there was no merit for. They would just hold on to them just to harass me, and they held on to them for 2 years. It ultimately destroyed my law firm. And then, of course, then in a family law case down in Miami, I ended up representing somebody in a high-profile case against the former Florida Bar president. And, again, I fought vigorously for my client, and I later found out that she had told her client, because her client became friendly again with her ex, that this attorney told her that her goal this year was to get me disbarred. So now I have an enemy that's the former Florida bar president mixed in with the elder law attorneys, you know, who have this vendetta. And, you know, nobody's dropping these complaints. Then I later discover that the investigator who ended up writing an investigative report falsified the record, stating that he was unable to get in touch with my husband to get, you know, a witness statement to what I had, you know, stated as my response. And my husband absolutely had spoken to him. We had the phone records. My husband wrote an affidavit that he had spoken to him. What are you saying? You know, you put in a report, you never spoke to me. My husband's a lawyer, you know, in good standing for over 20 years. And I brought this to the Florida Bar's attention, and then 3 days later, this investigator who worked for the Florida Bar for 7 years suddenly retired. you know, these are the little things that were happening. I was discovering, you know, that the Florida Bar had a nonprofit organization that they had, you know, they had created, and just a couple years ago, this nonprofit from the, you know, connected with the Florida Bar made a $175,000 donation to Miami-Dade's guardianship program. So, I mean, there's a lot of little things. I mean, I could be here forever telling you, I won't do that to you, but there's a lot of things that I discovered. So what I ultimately ended up doing is I said to myself, they have it out for me. And the way that their ethical rules are written are in such an ambiguous way that leads to subjectivity, right? They can create a case. They can create a case against whoever they want to create a case because their ethical rules are not written specifically. And I'm like, I'm a target. They're gonna do anything they can to take me down. And once I saw the fraud, you know, the lies, you know, the false reports, I said to myself, I had to take an oath for my state, you know, that I would put the system before anything. I would support this organization. And I said, I can't support this organization. So I filed a petition for retirement. I specifically put in the petition that I could not stand true to my vows, you know, my oath. And because I have to be a member of this organization to practice law in the state of Florida, I ethically cannot endorse this organization anymore. And if I can't do that, I can't be a member. And that means I can't practice as a lawyer here. But it was the principle. I could not support this organization after everything that I had discovered. And
right. Wow.
That's what happened. Yeah, that's what happened. You know,
This is Marcy. I'm so proud of you and welcome to the show. I won't be able to be on very long, but someone sent me a couple of questions to you. I wonder if I could just ask you.
Sure.
Okay. Being that there are millions of victims that have been trafficked by these out of control, juryless real estate and bank account thieves, as well as the human trafficking of children, adults, and elders, do you think that we are going to need a large-scale victim compensation operations-like movement? Movement of the 1960, wherein you saw a national effort and movement to correct the injustices that had become so prevalent, widespread, in commonplace, et cetera?
Well, I can tell you. Oh, go ahead. Are you finished? I didn't know if you're finished. I'm sorry, Marcy. Okay.
No, go ahead.
This was for Leslie.
Okay.
Question for Leslie.
So if I'm understanding this, do we need to have a movement to make change? Every time I am in a situation where, whether it be guardianship or whether it be removing children in child services, because child services, as far as I'm concerned, is evil. Okay. And I have my reasons for stating that. When I say child services, it's also adult services. They're one and the same. Okay, as far as it's just different, you know, divisions within the same state agency. Where things got really bad was with child services, and I'm going to get to answering the question, but I wanted to give you a little history. I went back to the history, you know, of everything that has taken place throughout time. And there was a federal act, you know, that incentivized adoptions and stuff in the 90s. All this had a negative effect on the ability to break up families. The movement, I think anytime you have a large number of people being vocal, drawing attention, I think it's going to at least get someone to listen to you. The problem, and I've stated this several times, the problem is each of our states have a three-branch government, just set up just like the federal government, right? You've got your judiciary, your executive, and your legislative. And you have it on a federal level, and you have it in every single state. And the legislative branch, they write the statute. The judicial branch, which is what your court system is, they interpret the statute. So until you get something changed with because you could do all the legislative changes you want to, but if the ones who are interpreting it are the judges and lawyers, they're going to skew it because they know how to manipulate words. So you can have a movement. I think that's important to get attention that something needs to change. But I think what happens is most people know that are, you know, higher up of the injustice that's going on, but until it becomes the majority, maybe 20% of the U.S. population, I don't know the percentages, who are affected by what we all have been affected by and seen, but I think they will always turn a blind eye as long as it hasn't hit the majority level, because all the Americans out there that have not been affected by this could never fathom that this is going on, right? They think
exactly.
You live in this, just, you know what I mean? So it's like, as long, so if you have, say, 30% of Americans have, you know, been affected by the injustice in guardianship courts, dependency juvenile courts, family courts. And then you've got, you know, the 70% of Americans that have not been affected. I think they're willing to let those 30% be affected and just turn a blind eye because they can. I think when you're really going to see change is when you have 50%, 60% of Americans, because it's hard to motivate someone to stand up to your cause with the level of passion that you have who's never experienced this. It's almost like you have to experience it. Do you know what I'm saying? So that's kind of, I don't know if I answered the question, but that's my thought process.
Yeah. Well, I think this is for this person that sent it. He goes, along the lines of reparation movement and national campaign, what are your thoughts about one of the many different class action suits and class action criminal complaints so that we may begin to combine these cases to show the widespread and prevalent abuse, theft, and fraud that is going on in these mock trial fraudulent court cases across the country being ran by fraudulent criminals posing as unethical judges or unethical attorneys and denying our rights to jury trials, to due process of a grand jury, as well as enforcement of the RICO Act and other federal and state statutes, criminal, civil, et cetera, and organized crime.
I can give you some insight into a little of the issues as to why it hasn't happened yet successfully. And I'll start with Florida for a second. When you're dealing with a federal act, you know, like RICO, the proper court to bring that in would be into federal court. You're dealing with a federal issue. The problem is, because I just dealt with this, because I did file a lawsuit against the state of Florida, and I did file a lawsuit against the Florida Bar, and I had several members of the public join me in this lawsuit, not as a class action, but they filed joinder claims. In investigating, I found out that the magistrate that was assigned to the case, who kept ruling against me on technical issues that really were not substantive at all, she was up for reelection in 2 years. And in order for her to be reelected, she had to get approval by the Florida Bar. Well, it just so happened I'm suing the Florida Bar. So how could she ever be unbiased? So I moved to recuse her on these grounds. I'm suing the defendants who are in charge of approving whether you get to be magistrate in 2 years. I think it's clear-cut conflict of interest. That was ruled against. You have to be a member of the bar to be a federal judge. And the problem is that you could have a huge class action, but there, what I have seen, because I actually went through the entire federal docket in Florida and on PACER, and I looked at every single case against, say, the Florida Bar, right? Every single one of them were dropped on a stupid technicality. Not the only one that stood was an advertisement, you know, claim. And so what they do in these federal courts is you could have an amazing, you know, argument, substantive argument, but what they do is they will get you on some little technicality, right? Like you didn't put a certificate of whatever on your pleading, so they're denying this, right? Yeah, I mean, it's, and then they'll just hit you on these technicalities to dismiss their case. So I don't think that it's impossible. I think you could absolutely do it, but you've got to, there's going to be jurisdictional issues because, you know, some people might have been affected in one state, others might have been affected in another. So obviously the class action, you would want to keep it, you know, confined to those that are residents of the state and just do multiple class actions across each state. But, you know, it's going to require being really on top of it. It's going to require, because the problem with what a lot of the injustice we see is that the judges and the magistrates have what's called discretion. And discretion, it gives them the power to interpret things in a subjective manner, you know, depending on what their motive is and whatnot. And the law allows this. So,
wow.
And people don't understand. And you know, that was like, a, you know, and we deal with this standard in guardianship and family court and dependency court, this best interest standard, you know, the ward's best interest or the child's best interest. There's been, you know, a lot of argument because of the way it's written. It's very ambiguous. When you have ambiguity, it opens up for subjective ruling. Because it's vague, it allows somebody to subjectively make a ruling, and it can be justified, and it can be held, and you can't overturn it because the law allows it. So there's a lot of issues that can go into. Do you understand? Like, it's a complex question to ask because there's a lot of issues that could affect it.
But the other question is that I'm getting these questions from someone. The jury witness and evidence tampering is prohibited by RICO Act. So how can these people get away with that?
What typically, it's not that they, what typically happens is the jury's at the end, right? The jury's when you're in a trial. You got to be able to overcome. It's like, it's almost like you're going into a war and you're going through all these obstacles. And in order to get to the finish line, you have to overcome A, B, and C. What typically happens when you file, say, a federal suit, they're going to come back and they're going to allege immunity, and then they're going to file what's called a motion to dismiss. Then you have to be able to overcome the motion to dismiss. So you might get dismissed early on in the game and never even get to see a jury trial to plead your facts, you know, to show the corruption, to show X, Y, and Z. There's a lot of things that have to be done, and it involves very technical lawyering and understanding of case law. Like, I've already researched all of the exceptions to their immunity. And, you know, I also helped somebody out of state in North Carolina on a federal claim, and I saw how the judge ruled in certain circumstances versus how the judges have ruled in Florida. And they rule completely different. You know, it's like what goes on in one court might not go on in the other, and you just can't predict it. And that's like the craziest thing. You think that this is like a black and white, you know, if I argue these exceptions and I meet the criteria, they can't dismiss it. Judges have a way of manipulating facts to support their rulings. And so you never know what type of judge you're going to get either. You know, it's just the whole system is, yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
So this is the last question. Do you feel that our constitutions, state and federal, guarantee that we have the right to trials by jury in all matters, all cases and causes of action, as the U.S. Constitution, Article 3 and Amendments 1 through 14, et cetera, as well as the state constitutions throughout make abundantly clear?
Well, here's the thing. I would have to, there's a lot of complexity, you know, because what happens is you can have writing in the Constitution, but then you can have case law that interprets what that writing means today in 2024. Oh. That's what case law does. Okay, case law is the interpretation of a statute. It's the interpretation of the Constitution. So you can go read a statute, and you can read case law, and it might be very clear that this is how it should go. But then what happens is that there's going to be certain words written that are going to be ambiguous, right? So then you go and you research the case law, and then it'll give you different facts and circumstances and how things have been interpreted. I can tell you in regards to a jury trial, I believe a jury trial should – this is what I believe. I believe every court, every case should have the option for a jury trial. I believe every person should be afforded an attorney, whether they can afford it or not. And that means not just afforded a state attorney, but afforded the ability to take depositions, to order transcripts. These are all extra costs that people without a lot of money have to accrue. And when they don't have the money, they don't get it, and it makes all the difference in their case. I believe all of that would help our system. The problem is that because of the judicial branches that each state has, that gives the judicial branch of that state the power on how to run their court system, it's not done by the federal court. It's done by the state judicial branch is the ones that are creating what you see in your state for your court system. And, you know, in Texas, they say they have jury trials in family court. but that's one of the only states I know that does that, because the states are allowed that power to decide those things. And most states are not, they don't allow for jury trials in particular types of courts other than criminal. And of course, civil, if you request it. And then I actually encountered something because I went, when I was representing a client in guardianship, we sued the guardian in civil court. We filed a lawsuit against the guardian and their attorneys. And then, of course, the guardian and attorneys moved to have the case brought back into probate court. And one of my biggest arguments to probate court was we wanted in civil court because we want a jury trial, right? And then all of a sudden the probate court judge says, oh, well, under this clause, I'm allowed to do a jury trial, right? So because they wanted it so bad to remain in probate court so they could be in control of it. So it's just, you know, it's hard to say, but I can tell you because of the state powers, no, that's why they're doing what they're doing, because they're allowed to, because in the Constitution, the states are delegated so many powers, and they get to do what they want with their state. And that's why you have Texas having a jury trial in family court in Florida, where you don't get a jury trial for family court.
But isn't that, but the question is, isn't that sort of the right according to the Constitution that people have a right to have jury trial, even if it's in probate court? And cases over $25,000 value, dealing with a person's children in custody, in cases dealing with guardianship of an elder, their freedom and competency, as well as the rights and the rights of the loved ones to remain together, they should be able to have jury trials for that.
Well, here's the thing, and I'm not saying I'd have to review that section, you know, to look at that, because I can't really speak without, you know, reviewing that section of the Constitution. But what I can say is, there's many rights that that are entitled to us. The problem is, and I have explained this because I do workshops and everything. The problem is the state has rights, and their rights are premised on what's called police powers. The individuals have rights, right? We have certain constitutional rights, you know, which, you know, we're not, you know, we shouldn't be discriminated against. There's many rights that we have. And then the federal government has certain rights. You know, to regulate, say, federal acts and, interstate commerce and things like that. What happens is when you get into a lot of cases, it's a power struggle between who rights are going to supersede over the other's rights. And so even though we have these rights and it's written in the Constitution, there's been tons of people, like in guardianship cases alone, that have had their individual rights trampled on. But the reason they've been able to be trampled on is because the state has the right to police power, and that means they have the right to protect their state citizens, their residents of their state. So it's a power struggle. And that's what, when you go to federal court, that's what the big deep meaning about what's going on in federal court is, yeah, we all have these rights. The state has them. We have them as individuals. Federal government has them. Whose rights are going, well, the argument's going to be, well, whose rights should supersede? Whose rights are more important when they bump heads, if that makes sense? It's hard to explain, but that's what ends up happening. And that was what is difficult for a lot of people, and including myself, is that we know we have certain rights. We're not getting these rights. Then, you know, we go to federal court and we try to argue them. But, you know, the argument's always going to stand. We learned this in law school and con law when we had to take it. The whole basis of con law and law school was, yeah, everybody has these rights, but whose rights are going to supersede over the other? That is always, it's always going to be a power struggle between individual rights versus state rights.
That is so scary.
Well, you know, this person just said,
unbelievable. So the fact that, so it's a myth then that grand jury trials by jury in the RICO Act, that's a myth then because it's so difficult to prove. So all these people can still get away?
What I'm saying is, I was confused on the question because when you're saying that shouldn't we have a right to jury in all areas of law? That was what I was trying to address. as far as like grand jury and things like that, I'm sure, you know, I mean, if like that is something I have not, like I have not encountered that in my career. So I don't like to speak on something that I haven't, because I'm a big research person. So I don't want to comment. I can comment on my experience. You know what I'm saying? Like why there isn't jury trials across the board.
Well, you know, I saw this movie, and then I'm going to let Duane and then you guys take over. I saw this movie. I don't know if you've seen it. It's on Netflix. It's called Fear City. It's regarding Giuliani.
I haven't seen it. I need to watch it.
Yeah. You really should see it, because he went to a university. Robin, do you remember the name of that university? Because I told you that.
Oh, gosh.
Remember we discussed this before?
Yeah, you're talking about
when Giuliani
went after the
mob.
Hold on, Marcy.
You're talking about when Rudy Giuliani went after the mob families in New York under the RICO Act.
Well, I watched that and I go, oh, my God, this is the same thing that I experienced in the probate courts. It's no different. But I'm trying to think of the school of law, which it was. I sent you that. Remember, I said watch this. Right. Everyone should watch this, because it really did make sense, and that's how he discovered the RICO Act, and that's how he got all those mafia people in New York.
Right.
Well, anyway.
So we are going to, Marcia, that's great. Thank you for asking those questions, first of all. I mean, it really does open the eyes up.
I'm just, you know, talk to people and they're too busy to get on the radio. So I'm always saying, hey, send me the questions and I got the questions. So there we go.
There you go. I get it.
Leslie, I'm so proud of you, and you know, I remember praying for you, and when one door closes, another one opens, because I really feel that what you're doing now, you'll be able to help a lot more people, and this is and I think that you're really doing God's work. It's the prayer of Jabez, you know. God, expand my territory without causing anyone pain, and keep me away from evil. And when you have enough people praying over you and you're trying to do what's best for humanity, I think that you can only do well. The light will shine against these people that are committing such cruelty against the human beings and the elders and the children. Shame on them. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcy. I appreciate your words.
Right.
Thank you.
So
any help you need, let me know.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank
you. So the next thing we want to talk about, Leslie, is that you do have a workshop, a family law lawyer's workshop. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think let me start by saying why I did it, because you have to appreciate, you know what I mean, like understand the why behind it.
Yeah.
Once I retired my license, I'm just going to touch on this very briefly. I went into a deep hole of depression. I didn't want to talk to anybody in the outside world. I was a recluse for several months, but there's always been this, since I was a kid, I've always had to fight for myself, to defend myself. I never had people defending me. And I've always fought for those that I felt, you know, were being bullied and picked on. So I guess inside of me, I could be a recluse for so long, but I couldn't get the voice out of my head that I have to change and I have to help people. It's like a fire that you can't get rid of. It's just part of who you are. And so I thought to myself, and there was many times even when I was a lawyer, I would think to myself, man, I really wish everybody had the education that a lawyer has. I really think, I'm really disgusted that America does not integrate that into our educational system, because all of us at some point are going to deal with the legal system. And, you know, the problem is it's so hard to get into law school for many people, or they can't afford it, or they don't have the time. And then you're always at the mercy of a lawyer, right? When you're dealing with something that can affect your life, can be life or death. And I've always had the mentality that I don't rely on people, because I've been burned by so many people, that I've always taught, like, that's why I can do so many various things, because I'm self-taught, because I always say to myself, I need to learn how to do it. Like, when my website was shut down by Bell South years ago, I learned how to build websites. When I couldn't cut music right, I learned how to produce music. I mean, I learned how to do everything, because I don't like to rely on people because of just my own personal history with people. So when I got screwed by the system in 2011, and I'd spent an astronomical amount of money in lawyers, and I tried to take my life over the situation. I was in a coma for 3 days, and I woke up, and I said to myself, I'm never going to put this control in another human being's hands, not when it comes to my child, not when it comes to my family. And that's when I decided I was going to go to law school. And it was the best friggin' thing I ever did in my life. The knowledge I learned, the reprogramming of my brain, was amazing. And then I got into practice, and having that experience even enhanced everything that I had learned in law school. And I would think to myself, God, I wish everybody had this knowledge. You know, like, I wish people, because if they did, we wouldn't need these jerk-off lawyers, you know, to pay all of our life savings to. So what I chose to do is I woke up one day, this is like 2-3 months ago, and I said, you know what? I'm going to provide an educational system to the public, to those non-lawyers that didn't get the same opportunity to go to law school that I got. And I'm going to formulate this program to give them a foundation so that they can competently navigate their case. Because the reality is, and this is what people don't understand, law is not science. You know, I used to, believe it or not, I was a chemistry teacher in my 20s. I was heavily into organic chemistry. Very black and white. You know, you mix sodium and potassium, and this is what you get, right? Law is not like this. Law, any client that came through my doors had a different fact pattern. There might have been fact patterns, you know, that were similar, but none of them were the same. So every time I took on a case, and this goes for all attorneys, we always had to research to the unique, you know, facts of our client's case. So what ultimately lawyering is the ability to issue spot, to figure out the buzzwords, the keywords to put into the search engine, to be able to research the appropriate statutes and case law that are relevant to the facts and circumstances in the case. It's research. It's literally learning how to cite issues and research it, and then, of course, legally write. And then, of course, you've got to be an oral advocate in court. there's a lot of layers to this. But what I decided to do was I said to myself, okay, if I was a legal coach, I'm just lawyering, and I'm just giving the answers away. I'm not helping people. I'm not really helping them learn, because they need to learn, because I might not be here for them tomorrow, and they need to learn how to do what I'm doing. So that was why I started Family Law Pro Se, because and what I did was I spent a lot of time, and I'm currently working on a book, the Bible for Non-Lawyers, to teach you the foundations that I learned in law school. But what I've done is I've taken my law school education, and I've condensed it down to the issues that matter in guardianship court and family law court and dependency court. Because, of course, you go to law school for 4 years, there's going to be areas of law that you're never going to even use when you're dealing with the cases that are in guardianship, family law, and dependency. So I've condensed it down. I've created free videos. And I also pulled the stats in family court. Okay, in family court. Now, guardianship is different because they mandate people that have a lawyer. But in family court, 70%, this comes from the ABA's demographic research, 70% of litigants are self-represented without attorneys. Of that 70%, 90% of those are actually Caucasian white females in their 40s and 50s. And they took surveys, and this is also unanimous with what's going on in Canada as well. They took surveys and they interviewed the 70%, you know, of these people, you know, like, you know, they pulled different people and they took surveys. And the biggest issue was they didn't understand how to navigate their case. They were very confused. Then I went out and I started looking at what resources are available to non-lawyers. Well, yeah, you can get on, you can look at case law, but is anyone teaching you how to read that case law? Is anyone teaching you how to use that case law? So I thought to myself, okay, well, yeah, they'll give you forms and templates and they'll give you, you know, okay, you can go jump on and, you know, to this legal search engine, but nobody's being really taught how to be a lawyer. And so that is what I'm doing with my business. And then I thought to myself, the reason, because I've researched this too, the reason that people are self-represented is because they cannot afford attorneys. So the last thing that I want to do is be a business that's going to have ridiculous fees and people won't be able to afford me because then I'm no different than lawyers. So I made the conscious effort to make it completely donation-based. You donate, that's it. There's no price requirement. I will help you. I will hold your hand. I will review your pleadings. I will do all of this. There is no – I don't charge you hourly because I'm truly – because the one-on-one, my coaching isn't – let me give you the answer. My coaching is, let me teach you how to find the answer, okay? And then if you have to go into court, let's have a Zoom session where I pretend to be a judge and you're there and I prepare you to be in court representing yourself. So it's kind of like a legal tutor, if you might, you know, if you say. The workshops are just another, you know, I try to keep it going because not everybody has the time, you know, to do the one-on-one coaching, but they might just want, you know, be interested in just getting a general foundation. So the workshops I'm trying to do on – I didn't do it this Wednesday because I'm interviewing, but I'm trying to do workshops once a week for people where they can, like, show up. We had a legal research and writing workshop last week, and I said to everybody, hey, send me a motion that you're drafting. Let's discuss it or send me an issue. You know what I mean? And I can use these examples to teach other people on what to do. And we got, and I shared my screen. We got onto Westlaw. I showed like, okay, here's your issue. This is how, as a lawyer, this is what I do when I get a case, right? And I take you kind of behind the scenes for what lawyers are really doing. Because all essentially, that is what I believe the public, if you want to truly be free, and here's the thing, even if you have a lawyer, having this knowledge is invaluable because you're going to know when you have a good lawyer. You're going to know when you have a bad lawyer. You're going to know if they're doing, you know what I mean? So how do you know whether a product is good if you don't even know what the product's supposed to be? So that it's just, you can't lose with this. And I try, and I purposefully did this and I did it the way that I did it because this is my way that I can give back to our country and to help those that have, you know, suffered from our legal system. You know, everybody has their strengths and their weaknesses. I have the knowledge of how to be a lawyer. I used to be a teacher. Like I said, I was a chemistry teacher, so I know how to teach. And I understand the system, you know, in a very in-depth manner. And so that is my way that I can make a dent, even if it's a small dent. And I'm also offering a sort of, I'm going to get into this more later once I develop all this and finish the book, but I want to get into a certification program where I certify people to be legal trainers and they can do the same thing that I'm doing for other people. And it just keeps filtrating and growing. And then people are not so in the dark anymore.
That is a wonderful thing. That is a really beautiful concept.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I grew up with an innate I just have never been able to stand by and watch someone with an advantage use the advantage to lord it over someone else. In other words, I don't like bullying, and I
no.
it's really hard for me to when I see it, it creates this compulsion in me to figure out some way to neutralize that, to straighten out this, you know, the situation, to recalibrate things, to put people on a, so that there's not this uneven playing field where one person has all the advantages and they just keep punching until the other person's you know,
down
and out. It's not, I don't like that kind of unfair contest. And that really what keeps me involved in this work of doing these radio shows and building this book with Luann is to help people to know how the game is being played, to know that you're entering into a rigged game when you enter into the courts. It's a rigged game, and there are people that have an advantage that they are using against you. And, you know, I've never been able to stand that. And it's like my own circumstances in my life brought me face to face with various things at various times. But one of them that was, you know, just real hard for me to ever get past was this third branch of government, the judicial branch, that has this unbridled, unregulated power to do whatever they want. And I've seen far too often that what that results in, you know, I can't remember who it was that said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But I've seen enough of the horrible corruption in these courts to realize that when a person has the kind of power that our judges have, where it doesn't matter what crimes are committed in that court, they can excuse them. It doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter what crimes are committed by people who are before that judge in that court. That judge can just bang a gavel and say, "Well, that's not a crime anymore," you know, because I say so. Ordinarily, it would be a crime for you to kidnap this person, but it's not a crime because I say so. Ordinarily, it would be a crime for you to take all of their bank accounts and spend the money however you see fit, but because it's not a crime. You know, ordinarily, for you to poison someone until they're dead, that would be murder. That would be a crime. But because I say so, it's perfectly all right. You can do that all day, and no one will ever cause you any damage. No one will cause you any harm because I say it's all right. I can't stand that. That's inequitable. That is a system that I look at and I say, well, that is corruption. That is an example of how something should not work. Because if we don't have some kind of equitable arrangement whereby criminals are dealt with as criminals and people who are not doing crimes can go before a court and say, hey, look, here's some crimes, and their evidence will be looked at and it will be weighed accordingly, and the person responsible for those crimes will have at least some decent chance that they're going to pay for those crimes. And in these probate courts, in many of these courts, in these family courts, these crimes are simply given to the perpetrators by the courts on a silver platter. And so, and I see how much of that is because these people that run the courts have invented a secret language with secret handshakes, and, you know, they have their own secret society with their own secret language, and that is what you offer a window into, so that people are at least are armed with the same weapons.
Yes,
that
right.
is legal right. language yes, and the perfect. Words and the understanding of how to approach the law that will give them the ability to have some ability to go into these courts with a degree of power that means that they're not absolutely at the mercy of unethical players. And I admire that greatly.
Yeah.
Right. And if I could just give my two cents.
No, go ahead, Hillary. I'm glad you're on.
Thank you. You know, I read what you were doing. Elliot posted something, and one of the things, and it's huge, that was mentioned by you, Wesley, was that, and all of us know it now. We didn't know it then, but we know it now, that you cannot go in with your emotions because no one gives a shit about you losing your daughter, you know, my dad going into guardianship. There is some sort of you know, method to their madness, you know, in the sense of this comes, that comes. But we're dealing with family members who don't have money. Often they're destitute. And the only way that they have a shot, which isn't a shot, is to go pro se, which even when lawyers go pro se against the Florida bar, you know, it's like, what are they doing? But just that one tip to me was like, if I had known that, because I remember I was on the phone to everyone and I was in hysterics crying. And I looked like a fool. Now I wouldn't be that way. But we need to help people from the onset of the tragedy in family court, more so because you can go pro se where you can't in probate. So, I mean, it is awesome what you're doing because you've got to be prepared when you go into court because they want to make a mockery out of you.
Oh, yeah, and then what they do, Hillary, what I've seen them do is when you don't, when you say file motion, you know, motions based on your emotion and it's not backed up with a standard legal analysis, then what they end up doing is deem you to be a frivolous litigant, and then they put a gag order where you're deemed now a frivolous litigant and you can't file anything. So, you know, what I teach people is to bulletproof everything you do, because here's the reality is that if you want to bring your issue beyond the trial court, the lower court, right? This is the lower court fact-finding court. If you want to say bring it to appellate court or wherever, the appellate court is not sitting there listening. Like if you have transcripts, yes, you'll refer to the transcript. What they do is they review your docket. So whenever somebody calls me that's a non-lawyer, they want to get on the phone and they want to unravel everything that's happened to them. And, you know, this happened, that happened. And then I listen, you know, I listen to them. But in my head, I'm thinking none of this is going to matter right now. What's going to matter is what your docket says. And I need to read that docket. Do you understand? I need to read and understand what the court has written. And the thing is that when you – it doesn't matter. If you go into court and there's no court reporter and you're going off on, you know, everything that's happened, that's not recorded. No upper court is going to see that. But what they're going to see is what you file in the docket. And you want – and the thing is that when a judge sees that a non-lawyer has a foundation enough to make a competent legal argument, the judge is going to be somewhat scared. Because the judge is going to know, well, this person could appeal my decision if I rule against them. When
exactly.
A judge sees that you have no idea what you're doing and they want to be biased against you, they're going to just say, okay, keep going. I'm going to rule against you. If I want to rule against you, I'm going to rule against you. I'm not the least bit afraid because I know you'll never prevail in an appeal because you don't even know how to legally write.
Right.
So you get what I'm saying, right?
Exactly. And to everyone, to all of our listeners, you know, this is a priceless tool that Leslie is providing. So, everyone's struggling, but it is a service and donations are greatly appreciated, whatever you can give, because I'll tell you two things. A, no one is offering this throughout the country that I know of who's been in deep with these people, members of the court, and who is smart enough to know what to do. And secondly, it's just so important that you're prepared when you go into court, you know. So, we're forever indebted, and I'll let you know just as we speak today, February 2024, Leslie, there's no one in the game like you. No one's replaced you.
You've always been amazing, girl. Like, I love you.
It's the truth. You know, Amber Patwell, she's a fighter. You know, she's really good. And I won't mention anyone else because, honestly, there's no need to mention anyone else because there isn't anyone but Amber and yourself. So you are greatly missed. And it's awesome that you're still doing this because most people would just do that. Give everyone, you know, the middle finger and say I'm moving as far away from this as possible. So we're forever indebted for you still trying to help victims in probate and family court who have no one.
Thank you, Hillary.
The truth.
It's the truth, yeah. So I was going to ask you too, Hillary, Leslie, so do you think that they give pretty much fair hearings to pro se litigants? Because a lot of people say that even when they have good documents, whatever, they have good proof, they're still not listened to in court. What do you think about that?
Well, the thing is that each judge, and I learned this as a lawyer, and again, you know, I learned this because I was handling a ton of cases, so I saw, and I never limited myself to one county, so I went all across the state of Florida. Each judge has their own procedures when it comes to evidentiary hearings and the submission of evidence. So, like, for instance, some judges would want me to drop off what was called a trial binder with all of my exhibits labeled, and it had to be done 5 days before the hearing. You know, other judges wanted me to actually upload each exhibit individually into ePortal. So the point is everyone, every judge has their own unique, you know, policy when it comes to the admittance of evidence. Then you have to make sure you comply with that. But then you have the rules of evidence. And I learned, and I'm going to say this because I was you guys. Okay, I was a non-attorney in 2011 representing myself. This is why I went to law school. I remember I got a letter from a psychiatrist, okay, because my ex-husband had taken my daughter away, deeming, you know, that I was mentally unsound. So I got a letter from my psychiatrist, and he said, you know, it said, you know, I'm fine, I've been compliant, there's nothing that concerns him about me, you know, parenting my child, yada, yada, yada. And I thought, as a non-lawyer at this time, representing myself, that all I'd have to do is give this letter to the judge, you know, like, come on, you know, like, it's right there, there's the evidence. And I remember I went into court and I tried to admit it into evidence, and the other side objected on hearsay, and he wouldn't even look at the letter. And he said, that's hearsay. And I'm like, how do you really mean that's hearsay? You know, because I didn't have any sort of legal understanding of what I was doing. But later, after I became a lawyer, I realized, okay, I get why that was hearsay. What I should have done was I should have subpoenaed the doctor to come into the hearing to validate, you know, that he did write what he said he wrote. Or I could have sent him what was called a business record exception form, in which he would have notarized that this was part of the business record, and that would have overcome a hearsay objection. So the point is that these are technicalities that non-lawyers don't understand when it comes to getting exhibits in. I'm offering all of this insight so that people can understand, like, if you have an evidentiary hearing and you've got certain evidence that you want to get put into the record, you first and foremost need to contact the judicial assistant for your case, ask the judicial assistant, what is the judge's policies on admitting evidence before an evidentiary hearing? Make sure you comply with that. And then you have to go through each exhibit and say, okay, what are the possible objections to these exhibits that opposing counsel can object on, right? So, you know, these are technicalities that a non-lawyer would not know. I didn't know it when I was a lawyer, but this is what I'm trying to offer non-lawyers in the work that I'm doing right now.
Wow, that's crazy great. You know, that's what people need, because I hear it all the time. Well, our case was kicked out because of a technicality. I didn't know how to present paperwork. So now everybody's going to have a tool to do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And that's what I'm telling you, Lou, like, take advantage. Like, right now I'm not busy. You know, I mean, I'm getting busier, but I'm not busy right now. And I'm working one-on-one with people. Because that, to me, you know, because each person's case is unique, so it's nice when I work one-on-one with them, because I can, you know, I can really, like, I'm working one-on-one. I work, like I said, this is not a money thing. Just so you can understand, I have been homeless before. I have had money. I have not had money. And I'm not someone that needs a lot of money. I just don't. Like, I just need bare necessities. I just don't, you know what I mean? I have to survive. That's it. You know, I'm not, like, some person. I've lived that life. I grew up in that lifestyle. It was a very negative thing for me. So I have, my point being is that I help a lot of people that can't even afford maybe even like a $10 donation. And I give them thousands of dollars or the value of legal expertise. You know what I'm saying? Of trying to help them. So, you know, and I do that because I truly want to help people. This is not, you know, like the donations are just because, you know, I do have kids, so it's time away from them. I have to be able to tell my husband at the end of the day that I'm not just, you know what I mean, having him watch the kids all the time that I'm doing this. But it's really, you know, it's really to help you guys. So if people need help, contact me. Don't think, oh my God, I can't, because I don't price tag anything. Okay, contact me. I will work with you. And there's certain cases I've been working with people where I feel very passionate and I feel horrible. There was a case recently, a woman sent me an audio of the authorities taking her kid from her when child services got involved. I started crying. I couldn't even finish the audio. It made me sick. I wanted to throw up after that. Do you understand? Like, I'm personal. Like, I actually take cases personally, and that could be good or bad. Maybe it was because I was a victim myself, but this is not a job for me, if that makes any sense. Like, this is truly, like, I'm on this earth. I've realized this when I woke up from the coma and God did not take my life, I knew that there was something that I was supposed to do on this earth. And that's the burning, you know, spirit inside of me that won't shut up, right? I'm trying to be, you know what I'm saying? For like a year, I was like, I can't, like, this voice won't get out of my head. And I really think it's God. I really truly do. But I'm just saying, like, I really want to help. I don't want people to suffer. I have been horribly hurt by humanity, honestly, like hurt by human beings beyond what I'm sure most of you can relate, actually. And there was times that I wanted to give up on humanity and just classify the entire, you know, group of humanity, the population of humanity, as evil. But I couldn't do that because I knew there was – not everybody's evil. Do you understand? And so I am really here to help you. That's my point. So
exactly. And that's exactly why we're here as well. And we have that in common, you know, because we feel the same way. I was so burned. I mean – so burned with my family.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's going to be able to read the story here pretty soon, but, you know, and I felt completely robbed, didn't know what to do. I was lost. I didn't know how to file for guardianship, which I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, because if you file for guardianship, you get everybody involved and you're screwed one way or another, you know.
Yeah.
But I did not know what to do. We were lost. So having this information and someone willing to help is worth everything. I mean, I can't tell you enough, you know, and I'm sure we'll be sending you a lot of people your way. So tell us, how do people get involved with you? I mean, how do they get in touch with you? How do they come and join? I know it's a family pro se, isn't it?
Yeah, it's family. I tried to make it simple, familylawprose.com. And what I did, I am developing a mini law school, and that is the only thing I've price tagged. That is it. But I still made it very cheap. But that I have not finished developing yet. You'll see that on the website, but I'm not finished writing that program yet. But if you go onto the website and you go under services, you'll see workshops, you'll see appointments, things like that. So you can just go on there, and if you want to attend the workshops, you can just sign up for the workshops. If you want me to analyze your case and read, you know, go through the docket and kind of do a little bit, you know, like be your legal tutor, you just make an appointment with me. It's not good to contact me directly to try to make an appointment, because what I've found is that when people have done that, other people have made appointments on the website, and it ends up getting, I get double booked. So I just tell everybody at this point, just book it on the website. Because that has my calendar, you know what I'm saying? And what happens is when you book it, it shows up on my calendar, and I already know ahead of time, and I can prepare, you know, to meet with you and whatnot. So it's really, I tried to make it super easy. You don't have to pay to book it. You just book it. That's it, and then I can help you. But what I will need, if you really, really want me to effectively help you, I will need to access your court docket and read the documents. Some of you guys might not understand, you know, because I've encountered a lot of non-lawyers that don't even know that that exists, but I can help you and guide you on how to get a hold of those documents. It depends on the state that you're in, but you would basically, you know, you call the county that you live in, the clerk of court, you tell them you're a party, case, you'd give the case number and you would tell them you need access to your documents. I absolutely need that because it doesn't do you any good calling me and telling me what happened, because what you're telling me can be totally different from what's in your court file. And if we're fighting a legal battle and I'm trying to help you in this fight, I got to know what's going on in your court file. When it comes for what you want to tell me, we can save that, you know, for when motions are being written and what story we want to tell. But I need to know procedurally what's going on. So that's important. But that's how you do it, Lewin.
Perfect. So we're opening up our phone lines now, and we've already got a lot of phone calls coming in from our listeners. The number you do that is 845-241-9962, 845-241-9962. You press a 1, and it's starting to really light up here, Robin. It's like,
we have a lot of questions.
Okay.
Well, let's get to some, shall we?
Let's get to some. Let's see. Let's bring in an 860 number. I'm trying to bring them in order. 860, you have a question or a comment?
860, you're live on the air. Welcome to the show.
I just opened up your line to speak. Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Welcome to the show.
This is Douglas here.
Hi, Douglas.
Thank you kindly. Hi, Lulu. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm okay.
Go ahead, ask your question if you have one.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate this entire dialogue. And again, my name is Douglas. I'm calling from Connecticut, and I would definitely like to speak with your guest, Leslie. I definitely could use your assistance, and I'm hopeful that Lulu and Robin will introduce us or maybe share a little bit more about my background. There's so many people online, I don't think I can go into all of it right now. But I'll make an appointment and we'll speak hopefully directly in the near future. And one of the things that I'll speak to right now is I heard another caller speaking about the legal positioning, certain type of pre-established tradition of law, but it's kind of for lack of a better word, silly to think that you can work within a corrupted system to the core and use their rules to win. And to me, that doesn't make sense, but that's another sidebar issue. The point that I want to make is in terms of the many different types of violations, at the core, would you say, Leslie, that it's a constitutional violation of our rights?
Which part? Like, what specifically? Like
the violation within probate courts, guardian ad litems, conservatorships,
yeah,
the judge.
Absolutely, it's a constitutional violation. And the problem is they're able to get away with it because, you know, that standard when they make someone a ward of the state that's called, I'm going to do this in the best interest of the ward. That standard is the legal standard that is – that they're exercising their police powers. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So what I was saying before, so it's, they're trampling on the constitutional rights every day. But they're doing it behind their police powers.
Understood. And so my situation is a involuntary conservatorship of my elder mother, who I was power of attorney, healthcare proxy, and executor of. And all of my roles were bottom line pissed on by the court and the judge and the attorneys, and they may have usurped or pilfered my mother liquid assets above $250,000. And it's all my fault.
That's how they get away with it. Like when someone has the power of attorney, what they do is they know that they have to make you look bad for them to take over.
Yeah.
So that's what they're going to file. They're going to file to say you're not exercising. You're actually harming the ward, or you're not. You know, you're being irresponsible, or whatever you're doing. It's going to be an attack against you because they want you out so they can take over.
There you go.
And they know. Yes, and they know that they're wrong, and I believe it will unfold, but that's the only play that they got, is it has to be me. There's something wrong with me.
Yeah, that's because you're in their way. You're in their way. You understand that, right? Like, you're in their way you know, if you look at, if you know, any estate, you know, planner or attorney, right, is going to say, oh, they're not going to tell you all this. They're going to say, oh, if you deem, you know, claim a power of attorney, that will, you know, prevent you from having a guardian if you become incapacitated, right? Or a healthcare surrogate. But what just ends up happening is the attorneys know how to manipulate. What they do is they end up filing suits, or they file motions or whatever they want to file that says that you've breached your duty and you're harming the person, and then the whole attack's on you. And then what happens is usually they're in with the judge because you don't know how much money they donated to that judge's campaign. I'm just telling, there's a lot of backward behind the scenes things that people don't realize. And the next thing you know, you're being made to be this criminal or this horrible person exploiting, and then they take over. That's their game.
Yeah.
Right.
I just wanted to, I don't want
to. Go ahead and speak. Speak briefly, because I can hook you up with her later.
Yeah, okay. And then I just want to put this out into the airwaves at a remedy. Solutions, which in my opinion must be something that covers a nation, can't be seen as a one-off in Miami or Texas or LA or whatever. So my feelings as it may have to be some form of something, a constitutional amendment that could be attached to a Bill of Rights of protection for elders and for children. So it's a new constitutional amendment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. You know, I personally think, you know, these people are not necessarily being regulated. I know that the federal government has, you know, like they do what's it called, FINRA, you know what I mean? They have these regulatory divisions that regulate things. I mean, that could also piggyback, you know, because sometimes it might take a long, I mean, if you're trying to amend the Constitution, you don't know how long that could take. You know, I think more oversight, and I think the key is oversight by somebody who doesn't have a leg in the game, someone that, because you trace the money, that's where this whole thing is, you know, the whole motivation is on money. Somebody that's not going to benefit monetarily, right, by what's happening to people that are put into guardianship, to regulate what, you know, I used to, I was a guest speaker in Palm Beach County, Florida, for telling the clerk of court how to, you know, recognize fraud in the docket perpetrated by attorneys. I mean, when attorneys start objecting, first of all, a guardian is supposed to hope the ward gains rights back. They're supposed to put them in a position to gain more competency and more rights. They should be filing suggestions of capacity all the friggin' time and doing whatever they can to get that ward out of a guardianship, okay? When you start looking in a docket and you see the only people that are trying to file suggestions of capacity are the family members, and then the only people objecting are the guardian's attorneys, that's a red flag to me. You know what I'm saying? That's a red flag. Why is the guardian fighting against a person getting better? So it's like these things are just common sense, you know, but it's got to be, you know, I don't know. But, you know, what I mean? I think there needs to be some sort of regulatory agency that comes in with no leg in the game to regulate these dockets and how these attorneys are acting.
Interesting.
Exactly.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think it's a good idea, but getting it in the Constitution or getting it amended is another job in itself.
Well, that could take, I mean, that's such a, I can't even imagine that part. If that was that easy.
Yes, I agree. But if there's 20 million people saying that, it's another story. If there's six of us screaming.
It's all in numbers. You're right. It's in numbers. That's why at the beginning of this interview, I said the reason they're getting away with this is because I haven't ran the numbers, but I suspect it's like maybe 30% of Americans are dealing with this. So as long as it hasn't hit the majority, they're going to get away with this. It's when it hits the majority of Americans that the Americans revolt against it.
agree with you. I appreciate you, your passion, and I look forward to connecting with you directly. My name is Douglas, and Robin will open the door.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going to get I'll let her know, everybody, when I'll talk to her again. I'll fill her in with everything. Trust me.
Thank you.
We've got
quite
a few people. Okay. Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Douglas.
Okay, let's bring, we've got so many people that want to call in. Let's bring in, let's start at the another top here. 386 number, you had your hand raised for a while. Did you have a question or a comment?
If that's me, yes. This is Bonnie Carter.
Hi, Bonnie.
And it's great, absolutely wonderful show. This has got to be the best show ever. So I'm a big fan of Leslie's, and she knows it. So I have one quick question regarding what you stated, states versus individuals. So if you have federal issues such as ADA Title III and other federal issues, does that supersede the state versus the individual?
No, because that is what's determined in a federal case, right? So what's going to happen is you're going to file in federal court. You're going to say, look, they violated this, and this of my rights, and they're going to come Go ahead.
How do you file in federal court? You have to start at the bottom and climb.
It's not hard. Trust me, this Bonnie. I by the way, I didn't tell you guys this. I had my license in the Southern Middle District Federal Court. It's not hard at all. It's just the same as state court. You just go into PACER. You know what I'm saying? And they have different like civil procedural rules. So you want to make sure you comply with that. They have different requirements for like their font and you know what needs to be put on the motions. But it's just. And I like federal court better than I do state court, personally. It's really not any different. Like, there's no – I think you get more justice in federal court.
We'll talk afterwards. I want to get your consultation on that, and I'm happy. You know, you and I.
Yeah.
And then the second observation that as a longtime – self-litigate and pro se, I learned a lot. I learned about, I made so many mistakes, and I guess that's why they punished me, because I wasn't perfect, but then my lawyers made worse mistakes than I've made. You know, like introducing the evidence and not bringing in the doctors and not even bringing in an office manager to say these are the true and accurate records. I actually was able to learn that and then finally did my own. I'm the only one of the few cases in Florida that was used in a textbook as a self-litigant that actually won anything, you know, which was the 5th District Court of Appeal. It gave me a beautiful win. Of course, it did no good because.
Thank you.
It was awesome. They ordered the removal of the professional guardian, and that I was to be heard again in court why I should be appointed guardian, and you know it was a great win, and always sit back down to the evil Knievel that does it all, which is the circuit court, guardianship court, and then so you go in front of the judge and you hear the, you know, at the end of a 2.5-hour hearing, you still get nothing. But they did their part because they did what the district told them to do. So it's a bouncy ball thing where the ball always comes back, you know. And I just can't believe all the years of litigation that I've had and all the suffering and pain that my son and I have been through, and nobody gives a crap.
No judge, nobody. Yeah.
So it's evil.
Well, I'm pretty sure Leslie can help you.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to getting with her.
I do want to say, go ahead.
I just wanted to make one more point before I forget it. which is, it's so obvious that the self-litigation is a reason, the obvious reason that that is undesirable is because attorneys need to make money. And
yeah,
it seems
but
like
you that's it, why so, you do not think they're going to try to come after me because I'm trying to help you guys supersede. Like, that, you know, like they came after this one company for tickets because they were offering a different solution for people that was more affordable. Florivar came after them claiming the unlicensed practice of law. You know, it's like they this is what they do. They control it because they're benefiting financially. That's why I say, like,
of course,
God, you know, people need the education that the lawyers have. You know, just like you guys said earlier, it's like you can't go into, you know, a war without the same tools. You know, you got to have them.
Exactly.
Exactly.
But okay, so let's get and move on. We've got we got a full load here trying to get on there. But
thank
Bonnie,
you.
We'll get,
thank you for
we'll
letting
get,
me
get in touch with her. I got all the information that we need. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Good. I appreciate it. So
and the lovely thing is that you all know now how to get in touch with Leslie through going to her website and getting a time slot if you want to talk to her about something.
Exactly.
Okay.
And let's go to a 616 number, 616 area code. You live?
Hi, this is Brandy in Michigan.
Hi, Brandy.
I just wanted to say it's awesome to hear someone out there willing to help educate all of us. That's what I've been doing and helping in any way, shape, or form. And it's the first thing is I teach people to go and check their register of actions. And you can do this online at most courthouses. You don't even have to go in person. It's to see what they're doing and what they're filing. And then sometimes you can even see the documents. And then when you're trying to fight pro se, every courthouse and every probate, online, there is a called a probate chapter book or rule book. So right there in every courthouse, it will teach you how to fight your case fairly, and it'll show you the process and how it works and what to file and when. So there's a lot of tools that are already available to everybody out there.
Exactly. Okay, good. On here?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good, good. That's good information. Okay, so okay, I've got so many phone lines on here open. Hold on a second. Okay, Leslie, you're still with us, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good information. Brandy, I'm going to keep your line open. We're going to bring a 770 number on right now. 770, question, comment. What would you like to add?
Hi.
Welcome to Face of the Deal.
Hi.
Hi.
Good evening. This is Becky Harbor, and I just wanted to comment on, I want to go to the comment that Robin said about the system being rigged. There could not be any more truth. Anyone listening here that was taken in a guardianship knows the corruption. They know what they're up against. With that being said, what I found in my personal cases, and I had four different attorneys, it was my actual attorneys, the ones that I was handing the, you know, $5,000 to, the $50,000 to, it was actually their moves that where they work with the other side. I know one of my attorneys said to me, he said something about you could have saved me. And he said, I can't save the world. And I said, no, I said something to him. And he said, I can't save the world. And I said, but you could have saved me. And, you know, he literally worked with the other attorneys. And you will find that in so many of these cases. And in fact, I would say more than 75% of the cases. It's sad, but it's true. And that's when Leslie speaks on regulation. I doubt we'll ever see that any more than we'll see jury trials, but it is needed. But I know when my husband was taken in the state of Florida, you know, I had so many things that after he died, I realized, like when Leslie speaks of going through the docket, that, you know, that's so true. You can give her your whole sad story. And yes, she's going to feel the compassion, but there's nothing like that docket. And I saw, you know, where I didn't have what was called due process, no evidentiary hearings, no acknowledgement of an advance directive that still stood in place. Point being, if I would have had Leslie, even though I would have had an attorney represent me in the court, I could have consulted with her. She could have looked at what the attorney was doing. Because you're so emotionally and physically drained when they have your loved one. And, you know, she could have said to me, hey, you're right. This is what they haven't done. And so at the end of this, what I'm trying to get over is the importance of, even if you have your own attorney, you know, donate to her, let her take the time to say, hey, this is where it's like when she speaks of the red flag, this is where I see the red flag. And that will be worth so much. It could actually be the life of your loved family member. And I know it would have been in my case. But anyway, I can't thank, you know, Leslie enough. I wish I would have had her. Anybody that's listening that has the advantage to this, please take it. I just sent over a very good friend of mine to Leslie, and she is like a different person talking to her now, the help that Leslie has given her in her case. And I really look for it to go a lot further. And so, you know, please, you know, anyone that really needs this second opinion, she is the person, and I'm grateful, and I just wanted to say that tonight.
Thank you, Becky. Thank you so much.
All right.
Have a good evening. Have a good evening.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Well, let's bring on a 7-0 guy. Kind of teared up a little bit. 7-0.
Can I ask a question real quick? This is Brandy. I've been contemplating, what if we went after these lawyers for breach of their fiduciary duties in a criminal court?
That is going to be, first of all, you can't go after someone in criminal court. It's up to the state to do that. So you can't, like, if you were to go file a complaint against somebody, you know, a case against somebody, it can't, you know, if you look at criminal cases, it's state versus the person, right?
Right, but like if a lawyer is defamating you and slandering you in the courtroom, when they have access,
you would have to file a civil complaint against them.
Why civil and not criminal?
Criminal because you don't have standing to file against them in criminal court. That is up to the prosecutor. So what happens when someone is accused? Yeah, something criminally, you report it to the police investigate it. If they find, you know, through the investigation that there's probable cause, they're going to send it to the prosecutor, okay, of your state, the assistant, you know, district, you know, whatever. You have different districts that have prosecutors. Then the prosecutor has the ability to decide whether or not they want to prosecute. It's called prosecutorial discretion.
Yeah.
I had actually a criminal case when I was being harassed. It was by an attorney, and it was by a former paralegal that I had fired. When I would just had reported it on behalf of the paralegal, they ended up sending it to the prosecutor, who told me that he's going to prosecute her. As soon as I added the attorney in, the prosecutor says, I'm not going to prosecute. I said, why? And he goes, because he used to work with me at the district office years ago, and I know him, and I'm not going to prosecute him, and I have the discretion on whether or not I want to prosecute. So remember, at the end of the day, if you're going after an attorney, just like what happened to me, they decided, you know, the prosecutor decided not to prosecute simply because he knew the attorney, because he's an attorney, too.
But if you have a proven trail of harassment and it continues,
you have to go to civil court for that. You got to do it in civil court. Now they have
man,
civil.
Man, that's a bummer.
Yeah, you got to do it in civil. You don't have the grounds to bring a criminal a criminal complaint. That's only the state that you live in is the only ones that can do it.
And then they claim privilege. The attorney claims privilege. I lost the case that way.
Yep, absolutely.
She won on privilege.
Okay. That sounds good. Let's see. Gosh, I don't even know where I'm at. Okay, let's go to 704 number. Hold on a second. 704. Hold on a second.
Yes, hi.
704.
This is Claudia. Hi. I called in a couple of weeks ago, and I'm so glad that Becky told me about this call tonight. So I have a couple of questions. I'm the one with my husband who's 55. He's in the hospital. My question is, how long, is there a long wait to get an appointment with you, Leslie?
No,
I've got,
no,
like,
I just started doing this. So that's why I'm saying take advantage now, because I just started doing this, like, I guess over the last month where I started taking appointments, because the month prior I was just working on videos to educate in my book and everything. But yeah, I have availability, so it's not a huge wait or anything like that. So
okay, great. I do have one question. So my husband was taken over the past couple of weeks. They have barred me from barred my daughter and I from visiting. So basically, right now he is isolated.
Was Adult Protective Services involved in this?
Adult Protective Services, yes.
Okay.
Oh yes.
Always.
They're involved.
Yeah.
My question is, my health care directive and my power of attorney were in the hearing, quote, suspended. There was never an evidentiary hearing. There was never a due process.
How long was it? How long ago?
This was in October.
Okay.
October 5th, last year.
Yeah, you kind of, like, if you and I had been in touch then, I would have demanded, you file a motion for rehearing on that order, and if they denied it, then I would have actually appealed it. But you've missed the timing for that.
Yeah. They cut the timing short, too. There's all kinds of, it's just lies, right? But I was thinking, like with a writ,
corpus. Yeah, writ of
corpus, right? Because he's in the hospital. I guess my question is, with my durable power of attorney, because it has not been revoked in the courts or anywhere, would it not be smart to do a habeas corpus, because then the custodian, who is the hospital at this point, would have to provide paperwork. I mean, they would have to provide what authority they have to hold him. Right?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I would definitely do that. have they filed a petition for incapacity?
Oh, yes. Well, that's what we went through.
Okay, so have they got a guardian? Do you have the order for guardianship? Like, did they appoint a guardian?
No. There was a nefarious petition that went out by a family member. That family member had been investigated by Adult Protective Services in another state, and by Adult Protective Services and the police in another state, and that person is now the guardian. We live in North Carolina, and they keep telling us
what
transferred to New York.
What?
I'm sorry?
What county are you in?
Mecklenburg.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm helping a woman that had a case where her adult son was taken by DSS in Mecklenburg County. I went through the docket in Mecklenburg County, and nothing came up for orders of guardianship. So then I contacted the clerk of court in Mecklenburg County asking for all the papers. And it's very – there's some stuff going on there. That's all I can say.
Leslie, I think I connected them a couple weeks ago, who you're talking about on our show.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Kathy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah, I'm helping her right now. Unbelievable.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yes. So, but is there, like, I guess my question is, can a durable power and a healthcare power of attorney be suspended?
Yes, it can. And this is the disgusting thing about this whole thing, right, is yeah. what they're going to do. Anybody, like I told the previous gentleman that was, you know, that was speaking when he was saying that he held the power of attorney, what they're going to do is they're going to peg you to be the bad person, the bad one, right, because they want the power that you hold. Yeah,
they've done that all along.
If they create an argument to be revoked from you,
to be a hearing for that.
Well, this is what you got to stay on top of this, because what they're going to do is they're going to try to, like, they can get ex parte order. They can go in, and you got to make sure that you've got all of your information registered with the clerk so that you have proper notice. Because they can go in demanding to have, you know, filing an emergency motion to get an ex parte order.
Okay.
And that ex parte order does not afford you.
Can everybody mute the phones? They're not speaking.
Well, I haven't been informed of anything.
We have a lot of...
I've been down to the clerk of court's office, and they pretty much told me that it's online and I can look it up.
Well, no, you need to let them know you're a party and that you're requesting,
like I did.
You request for the all of the documents in the safe. If you go to Mecklenburg County, I just got all the documents.
Okay, are you speaking of the things in e-court? Because I see all those.
Yeah, no, but you got to get all the documents in your docket. Yeah, if you're seeing everything in the e-court, I mean, if that's all the filings.
No, I don't see every single document, because there are documents that I remember that I'm not seeing there.
Well, then that's when you got to contact the clerk of court, ask them that you want all of your documents.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, and then we can also get you in touch with her as well, Leslie.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the emergency is, I don't know how many more days, or I really don't know how much longer my husband has. I hate to say that, but that's the fact. He's nothing but skin and bones. And that's why they want me out. They do not want me there.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
So
of course
they
don't want you involved. You know, we get that all the time, where they don't want families involved because
that's their adversary. That's their adversary.
Because in their way.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. But to fight them, you know, the only way you can do it, that's what I'm saying, like, it's hard for me to say anything because I have to read the docket. I have to read what's been ordered, read what's been filed and ruled on. Like that, because that is the fight that people don't understand. Like, yeah, we all know this is unjust. We know this is corrupt.
Right.
We know that this is common sense. But you're in a different war. Okay, you're not in the war of what is just and right. You're in a legal war, and you have to learn the legal language, and you have to do the legal fight. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel bad for everybody who calls me and tells me what happened, but I can't help them unless I know what the legal war is.
Correct. Yes, like, I understand that.
Yeah.
It's just really, I guess what's difficult on this, it's just been one lie after the other. So why file a motion? Because you already know that everything is set against you. You know,
well,
it's kind of like what does.
You got to understand. You got to file. You file motions, legal arguments, and you do this to preserve your ability to take it to a higher court. That's why you file motions. You're not expecting that the lower court.
So I can take it to a higher court.
What?
Okay, I guess. Okay, just so
like you're creating a paper trail. Yeah, you're creating a paper trail, but you got to make the legal arguments, because what's going to happen if you try to take it to a higher court, and it's not on the record, which is what your docket is, if it's not filed, you're not going to have – you can't argue it in appellate court. You missed the mark. They're going to – because the appellate court is there to argue what the state court had the opportunity to rule on. And if you don't give them an opportunity to review your legal arguments and then you take it to appellate court, they're going to say, we can't review this. You never made the argument in lower court.
Okay.
There you go. And I would suggest that you contact Leslie Joy and talk to her more, too, on her website as well.
Thank you.
Okay?
Yes,
okay.
I will do that. I will reach out to you, Leslie. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. Nice
okay, good. Yeah, thank you. And we got one more caller, 845. You're with us live.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Uh-huh.
Hi. Leslie, I followed you when you were going through all the turmoil with all these rats in the Florida bar. And, you know, it was just disgraceful. But I'm so happy to hear you tonight. You sound wonderful. And I really admire your tenacity and courage to establish a school and to establish all this help to all of us poor slobs out here who need help. Excuse me. I just have a couple of quick questions. One, in the beginning of your presentation tonight, you mentioned that the Florida Bar had established an organization. I didn't catch the name of it, if you did mention it.
Yeah, let me look it up. Hold on, because it's a nonprofit. They started this whole thing. Bar nonprofit.
I was just curious.
And they're mandated to have transparency, so you can actually go in. Okay, it's called, hold on, the Florida Bar Foundation. That's what it's called. It's their 501c3 public charity. And they have to have transparency, so they will, if you look on the website, you will see where donations are made, who is donated to them, because you'll notice, too, big donations are made from big law firms, right? So why are these huge law firms never in trouble with the bar? It was funny because when I did a video exposing a case in one of my guardianship cases to demonstrate the injustice. And I got disciplined for that, by the way. I was not allowed to inform the public of the injustice going on. I used the name John Doe, Jane Doe. Like, I didn't use anybody's name. I didn't disclose any specifics. And what I really disclosed was what was going on in the majority of my cases. And they shut me up. I was ordered to go to, for a year, I was on probation over this. And I also called a judge unethical, and he was. And he ended up admitting he made a mistake, and he vacated an order. That's a whole other thing. But those are the two reasons I was on probation, okay? And on Wednesday nights, I had to sit with a group of attorneys who were also on probation. Not one of the attorneys were from a large law firm. They were all sole practitioners, but they were mostly minorities. And they were trying to take these attorneys out. And the ones that, you know, like, it's the big players, the big firms, they donate. And they can do that. And another thing that the Florida Bar allows is there's insurance offered to attorneys to defend disciplinary actions. Now, that's a conflict of interest. That originated from the Florida Bar. So say that I wanted to secure that I didn't get into disciplinary trouble. I could pay money to this organization for insurance to defend me in disciplinary actions, which the Florida Bar originated. Do you understand the craziness of all this? Yeah.
It is. It's totally crazy.
Yeah.
Another question or two, maybe a follow-up. What do you think about the when you were doing your guardianship rescues or your cases with parental alienation, did you ever cite the fraud upon the court or fraud by the court, and were you ever successful? If you did.
That argument comes when you see fraud upon the court. That argument comes when you're trying to vacate an order. See, the problem is that you have to start – there's like a checklist that as a lawyer, this is what I do. If I have an issue, I first go to the rules of civil procedure, okay, which every state has the rules of civil procedure. What the rules of – it's like playing a game of chess. The rules of civil procedure tell you what you're allowed to file, okay? And because, you know, you might, there's tons of injustice that happens every day, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that our courts have a remedy for it. All right.
So you have
to first and foremost go to what are you allowed to file given your issue? So if you have an issue, say, with an order that you feel should be overturned, then what you're going to do is you're going to go to the rules of civil procedure and you're going to look up, you know, what allows me to overturn an order. And it's going to say, you know, rule such and such for a motion to vacate. And then what's going to happen is it's going to say, well, in order to get a motion to vacate granted, these are the different factors that you must prove to the court. And one of those factors could be fraud upon the court. Okay, that's the only time I've seen fraud upon the court. It's when you're trying to vacate an order. And then what you have to do, then it's going to go even farther. And it's going to say, well, what type of fraud? Is it intrinsic fraud, extrinsic fraud? Then you're going to have to go to case law. You're going to have to have case law defined, you know, what is intrinsic fraud and extrinsic fraud? What constitutes fraud upon the court? Because although you might think it, you know, your circumstances is fraud upon the court, if case law says no, it's not fraud, you know, upon the court. So you have to research the case law after you research the civil procedural rules. And then when you're arguing your facts, then you could go to more case law, you know, to argue, you know, for or against or why they should, you know, find fraud upon the court and reverse this order. So it's a checklist. You don't just say, oh, my God, this is corrupt. This is unjust. This is what happened. You never start there. You say, okay, something's not right. What is it legally that's not right? Well, this order should never happen, right? How do I vacate this order? That's how you have to start thinking. And that's so confusing to someone that's not a lawyer, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and then finally, just real quick, if the do you personally perceive what is happening, whether it's in the family court or the probate court, and what they're doing with children and, you know, families and, you know, taking hostages and putting them wherever in these inferior, you know, facilities and all of that, and then stealing the people's monies and all of that. Do you consider that under the guise of human trafficking? I'm just curious if you do.
I mean, I think the whole thing is revolved around financial gain. I think when it comes to guardianship courts, I think that the pharmaceutical companies, because they always put people on specific medications, I think the nursing homes are making money. I think the real estate, you know, profession is making money. It's all financial gain. And when you get into guardianship,
it's a matrix of diabolical things going on.
That's all it is. Then when you get into child services, they get federal funding because of the 1990 Federal Act that was passed. They get federal funding for every child they adopt out. So what happens, and then the adoptive parents end up, you know, at least in Florida, if they adopt a child with a disability, they get $10,000. If they adopt a child without a disability, they get $8,000. Then on top of it, the adopted child now gets their entire education within that state and college paid for. It's always financial incentive, always. And what happens is you have certain federal acts that compensate states for, you know, doing X, Y, and Z. So there could be federal funding that they're getting, and you got to research that if you really want to get deep. You research what federal acts are giving the states federal funding and what the criteria is to get that federal funding. And 9 times out of 10, you're going to figure out this is all financially motivated completely.
Absolutely. That's always the bottom line. And just a real quick follow-up, Homeland Security is, you know, it's under their purview that, you know, they watch out for human trafficking in the United States of America and internationally. I think personally we need to be going to Homeland Security and the State Department individually and collectively to discuss this human trafficking that is not being addressed by the people who are perpetrating it.
The problem, I'm going to tell you again, this is the problem. The problem is they know this is going on, but it's not affecting the majority of Americans, right? It's maybe affecting 30% of Americans. So until nobody's going to do crap unless you have an uproar by the majority of Americans that have had it and are unwilling to tolerate it. Or you perpetrate a crime on someone with big money, big influence. You know what I'm saying? Like a Walt Disney. You know what I mean? Which I know that there were some issues with guardianship there. But what I'm saying is that, you know, you like that's the problem. And until that happens, you have to know how to protect yourself.
I mean, historically, it doesn't take the masses of people to experience the atrocities. For instance, slavery, you know, the women's suffrage, the civil rights movement. It takes persistency. It takes loud voices of even a smaller amount of people like us. But
we can do that. No, I'm not saying that you can't. You absolutely can do that. But what I'm saying is, when you're talking about like homeland security and things like that, you know, it's going to be a harder, it might, I'm not saying don't, I mean, I say believe in everything and go for it. You know what I mean? Like there's nothing to stop any, you know what I mean? But I'm just saying the you have to look at like hope versus the reality of things, you know? And I mean, I have hope and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, you know? But it's the reality is, you know, when I started researching throughout time, I've researched all the way back to the 1600s. This human trafficking has been going on. I researched the intent and the origination of guardianship, so how the whole thing evolved. And I'll tell you right now, one of the worst things that is broadened, and I'll explain it like this. Back in time, when guardianship originally came about, it was in the UK, right? It wasn't even in America at that time. It was to protect children who lost their parents' property until the children reached the age of maturity. Okay, that was the original intent behind guardianship, is when the child lost their parents, they came into money, and they were too young to understand how to, you know, to handle their money. Then all of a sudden you get these, you know, diagnoses, or not even, it wasn't so much pharmaceutical medical diagnosis, but then you have people that they called crazy, right? People that questioned what was going on. They would stick them in insane asylums. They expanded the guardianship power because now you got people that are deemed to be crazy, although I would beg to differ that they were crazy. They probably just questioned what was going on. Then we evolve into where we are now, and we've got all these diagnoses that aren't even founded on objective scientific testing. We've got, you know, all these disabilities. Now we get into the autism spectrum, which, you know, you can diagnose them with autism that might not even be severe autism. And these diagnoses done by the pharmaceutical companies and the medical doctors, because they want to be able to bill, you know, for, you know, different things that medically are done for a certain diagnosis, has now expanded even more. You know, somebody might have dementia, but it doesn't mean that they can't survive. It doesn't mean that they have to be institutionalized. But this is the problem. It works. The problem too is hand in hand with the psychology field, the medical field, and these diagnoses. And now you in child services. Now you got the psychology field. You know, talking about, well, it's mental abuse. Well, how do you define mental abuse? It used to be just abuse where a kid would be banged up because their parent was truly abusing them. Now you've got a parent that takes the kid to the hospital. Now they're Munchausen by proxy because they don't agree with the medical doctor. This is the problem. It keeps expanding.
Yeah, we're going to have to go ahead and
Thank you, Leslie, and God bless you and good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate you talking about that. And we also have a big segment going in our book with the whole family trap as well. We have Debbie Kelly used to be on our radio show, and she did the fourth branch, and she's going to be doing a whole, you know, a big chapter coming on as well in the book that we're putting out. Anyway, go ahead and tell everybody one more time, Leslie, how they could get a hold of your workshop. I know it's www.familylawprose.com, right?
Yeah, it's just www.familylawprose, you know, SEPROSE.com. And then you just go under services, and it will have everything. And everything is donation-based, except for the mini law school that I haven't finished doing yet. But everything else is donation-based, tons of free resources, and it's all educational.
All right. And with your permission, we're going to talk about this at the end of every single radio show, how they can get some help now. So this is going to be really exciting for us. That we actually work together and we can start helping a lot more people here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm happy to put your, you know, if you have a link to the show on the website, because I do my website, because I've learned to do everything in my life, but you know, but I can definitely, you know, encourage anybody who visits my website to listen, because you guys provide such a great show. It's raw, it's truthful, and it needs more, more Americans need to hear it.
I know, and I think us all working together, and I'm hoping that you come join AUI as well. That would be wonderful.
Yes, I am. I spoke to Belinda, and I have it on my calendar to do it, so I plan to.
Okay, well, because we're on that board as well, so we'll all be working together. It's wonderful what's going on, and that's our show for tonight.
Thank you, folks. We appreciate your tuning in.
We're going to be getting Belinda Parker Brown on our show real soon as well, so maybe we'll have you both on. That would be a real exciting show. Anyway, thank you for tuning in. Robin, go ahead.
Justice requires transparency and accountability.
And giving up is not an option.
So we're with you. We're standing shoulder to shoulder, arm in arm, to stop the corruption in our courts that we see every day. We thank you for tuning in. We're going to keep on fighting for you. You can always find us at blogtalkradio.com/hiddentruthrevealed.
On Blog Talk Radio.
On the blog, www.blogtalkradio.com/hiddentruthrevealed, where our shows are all archived, and you can go and listen to this again if you didn't get everything and you want to make notes. You could go and listen to any of our shows. They are archived there. So,
good night.
Join us again. Good night. We'll
thank you,
Leslie.
Everything you do is absolutely wonderful. Thank you. Appreciate it. You're going to be
you guys.
So many.
Absolutely. You're definitely in our mutual admiration society.
Yeah. And Hillary and Marcy, we love you. Thank you for joining with us every Wednesday night. We'll be back again next week. We'll let you know who our guests will be again next week.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Here's a commercial from NASGA, Association Stop Guardianship Abuse. There you go. Good night, everybody. Supposed to be coming on.
Did you know that elders and others are losing their rights to liberty and property? Anyone can petition a court to have a person deemed incapacitated. What if that person is you? The adult guardianship system was created to protect incompetent people and their assets. A court-appointed guardian, sometimes a total stranger, can force you into a nursing home and sell your home to pay for services. Treasured belongings can disappear as you are drugged and isolated from loved ones. Why does this happen? Unfortunately, the courts don't have the funding to supervise and audit cases. A guardian makes all decisions on your behalf, taking control of your assets with little accountability. The potential for abuse is frightening. Luckily, not all guardians exploit those under their care, but when they do, there's really nowhere to go for help. The National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse, NASGA, is working to reform adult guardianship to return it to its once noble purpose of protecting the human rights to life, liberty, and property and ending financial exploitation of assets. Are you or your loved ones protected? To learn more, visit stopguardianabuse.org.